Well, one type of communication technology that of course is just everywhere now is the internet. And there's some pros and cons to that. I mean, one pro is that you're listening to us right now. Well, we deem that to be a pro. You're listening to a podcast that I'm pretty sure you got off the internet.
Welcome back to Roundtable, a podcast produced by Mid-America Reform Seminary. This is episode 35, and I'm Jared Luchvor. Thank you for joining us. I'm joined here today with Reverend Andrew Compton to discuss the church and media and technology. Reverend Compton, how are you doing today?
Doing well. Thanks, Jared. Awesome. It's really interesting to have you actually behind a microphone here. We don't normally get to hear from Jared.
It doesn't happen very often, except when I'm introing and outroing. Well, we're here to discuss media and technology and its relation to the church. You know, no doubt, if you're listening to this, your church's media presence has grown or perhaps even begun in this era of COVID-19, whether it's your website, live streaming capabilities, video production, all these things, forcing us to ask this question, you know, how do we handle media and technology in a stewardly and a God-glorifying way? I want to just read a quote that was published in the Christian Post article a few years ago about technology. And it says this: technology is both a blessing and a curse when it comes to modern Christianity. Through channels like Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, the church is able to influence thought and culture in ways unseen just over a decade ago. Conversely, the convenience and rising popularity of quote-unquote online church and webcast worship services have threatened the face-to-face fellowship of believers encouraged in Acts 2:42. As the media plays an increasingly large role in the lives of most American Christians, we must critically examine the benefits and drawbacks of its influence. In doing so, we must ask ourselves how we can use media to enhance our spiritual lives, further the growth of the gospel, and be instruments of salt and light in a fallen world. Reverend Compton, before we engaged in this conversation, we were talking a little bit earlier about how Christians cannot be anti-technology. Can you flesh that out just a little bit more?
Yeah, that sounds pretty sweeping, doesn't it? As though, Christians cannot be anti-technology means we can't oppose certain kinds of technology that are only designed for destruction. That's certainly not the case. But more, we were talking about just the creational implications. The creation mandate itself is something of a technology mandate. It's interesting that Tim Challies in his book The Next Story goes through something of a biblical theology of technology. There's a mandate for technology, the filling and subduing. Now, maybe you feel as though subduing the earth maybe is a more primitive kind of technology. You can use a plow, you can use a shovel, but that's a far cry from using an internet.
Right.
And you can reflect that, but at least I think we should step back and be able to say there's something right about the development of and use of technology. There's something creational about that. There's something human about that. And it is really telling that even our Bible as we know it is the evidence of God and his sovereignty and God's providential decision to utilize a form of technology to preserve his revealed word. Now, we don't often think that. We just think, well, a book, right? Writing on paper, that's fine. What could possibly be wrong with that? Well, there's plenty that a lot of people have thought is wrong with that, right? You can think of the book burnings that happened throughout history because books are deemed to be very powerful things. But just the fact of writing a language on paper is a technological decision. It's a decision to use a particular kind of technology. And it's intriguing that the Bible, comes into a world like that where there was much disagreement on the value of books. So the Greeks, for example, went into all kinds of debates about the value of literacy and the value of being able to write and being able to read and produce books. And Plato, for example, is famously quoted as being very anti-book, because he said, well, if you can read and write, then you merely give the appearance of wisdom. The true wise and knowledgeable person is the one who has memorized and who can recount and preserve orally traditions. But to write is actually a lesser thing. It's what stupid people do. Wait a minute. Us people who value a particular book, the Bible as the Word of God, would think, well, that's absurd. But that's because we kind of take for granted that a book is a form of technology.
Mm-hmm.
And we've seen it used very positively. And we've seen all kinds of good books used very positively. But we always need to, I think, keep that in mind, that we can't be anti-technology consistently
mm-hmm.
without claiming that we shouldn't have the Bible as a book. So that's kind of where we were going with that. And that at least then gets us evaluating other kinds of technologies. Communication technologies are what we're really focusing on here. But how do those other technologies help or hinder our dependence upon this book and our propagating of the message of this book throughout the world? Well, one type of communication technology that of course, is just everywhere now is the Internet. And there's some pros and cons to that. I mean, one pro is that you're listening to us right now. Well, we deem that to be a pro. You're listening to a podcast that I'm pretty sure you got off the Internet. I don't even know if people can put our podcasts onto a cassette tape. Can they?
I have no idea.
Some of our listeners don't know what a cassette tape is.
What is that?
But there's clearly pros and cons. How have you, Jared, you know, not only have you studied theology here at Mid-America, but you've studied media and you work in media and you wed media and technology together. How have you thought through questions of pros and cons in the Internet? What are some of the pitfalls? What are some of the benefits? And maybe that can frame some of the things we talk about here.
Yeah, I mean, for anyone who doesn't know, I studied at Dort College and graduated with a degree in digital media production. Granted, the vast majority of that course load was in film work, but we also had mass communication classes where we talked about technology and its effects on everybody in their lives and stuff like that. And having now been in the marketing world for a few years now here at Mid-America Reformed Seminary, I've been able to witness firsthand the pros and cons for how technology influences us as Christians in this world. Certainly, the way that we can communicate one message to thousands, you know, if not millions of people all at once is certainly a pro.
Sure.
I mean, how many times has one sermon been listened to on sermon audio, for example, how many times by not just people in America or Canada, but in so many different countries.
Mm-hmm.
This podcast, for example, even I have statistics that show that we have people in Vietnam, listening to this. So having that access, you know, of course, is a huge pro to this. It's allowing people to experience things live for the first time, too. Mm. I mean, consider what churches have been going through for the past 2 months.
Right.
It's forced churches and congregations to do something that they've never done before. We can consider ourselves anti-technology at times, but when COVID hit, how many churches had to pick up live streaming capabilities and video production, or perhaps my church, for example, had to jumpstart our website. We weren't finished working on it yet, but we needed to get that platform out there for people to hear our sermons online. So that made us as a council to make decisions rather quickly. So getting websites out there, crafting media platforms as congregations. In a good way that's helping all of our listeners here as best as we can.
It does. It is interesting how you just described that COVID kind of scenario, because I can think of how many churches all of a sudden started Facebook accounts.
Right.
Who had never considered whether that might be beneficial or not. All of a sudden have Facebook accounts. In fact, one of the churches I drive past on the way here, is a church that I don't think has ever had a website, except now their board out front says streaming live on Facebook.
Mm. That my church had to amp up our Facebook presence quite a bit. We started a YouTube channel. I'm sure other churches had to as well. You know, this really gives a whole new meaning to the what we mean as a watching world. You know, when they're watching how the church operates in this way, they're almost watching digitally to see how this the church is functioning at this time. So I think in those ways, certainly. The quick and easy access to resources and to the word being preached online. Those are the pros that come to mind.
Think of what would the church have even done if there had been, if this pandemic had hit in the pre-internet age. Of course, we have historical precedent, and I unfortunately can't cite any statistics. If our resident church historian, Dr. Strange, were here, I'm sure he could speak to that, but imagine what we would have done.
Right.
I mean, how would our congregations have heard teaching from the Bible? How would we have stayed in touch? I mean, could we have delivered tapes, written notes? I mean, those are all fine things, but this is quite remarkable that individual churches were able to provide a semblance of normalcy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, there's challenges with participating in that normalcy. For example, you can put your sermon or the service up on the TV screen, but your family sitting in your living room now has to somehow dissociate life in front of the tube on a normal time from this experience of sitting in front of the television.
Mm-hmm.
So there were challenges like that too,
right.
but it really did. I think the internet gave a way of some type of presence, and I'm being real cagey about that because it's not really presence, but there's something that we were able to accomplish through the internet that was very positive. And we're thankful we didn't have to go through a shutdown and a pandemic without such things.
Yeah.
You know, you'd mentioned too, just about getting resources out and more widely known. I think for the Reformation, or I should say for Reformed churches, today and in the last 20 years, for example, the internet has been incredibly beneficial for the work of reform, not only the work of evangelism, but specifically the work of reform, in that people wanting to learn about a passage, right? Somebody's finally stumbled upon Romans 9, and they're just not really satisfied with how their pastor explained what it means that Jacob I've loved, Esau I've hated, and how does this whole predestination thing work out? Google, or,
right.
You know, pick our search engine from back in the day. Click, 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 Romans 9 or predestination. And churches and think tanks and institutions and school, you know, anybody who's spoken to this has suddenly got a connection to this person who's looking into this.
Right.
And one thing I remember, now this is not exactly internet, although internet was going, is when I first came across the radio program The White Horse Inn, and I listened to a number of these episodes of these really good Reformed reflection and discussion, and in my mind I went, oh, White Horse Inn, well, these guys must all be in Michigan because that's where all the Reformed people are. Well, come to find out, not only am I living in practically the same city as one of the hosts, but I'm about to start teaching the kids of one of the hosts. You know, Kim Riddlebarger's kids were in the school I was teaching at, and so
funny.
What do you know?
Right.
But this technology put me in contact, even though I was in the same town. I hadn't come across this or stumbled across this. But not only did the White Horse Inn enable people all over the world to learn about Reformed theology, but it enabled people within cities to get connected with Reformed churches. Now, we were in one Reformed church, but had an opportunity to worship with Dr. Riddlebarger's church, and in time go on to we moved there, and I became a pastor there, and to this day, Kim has been a great friend and a great encouragement.
Mm-hmm.
Funny how technology, how the internet, how radio waves enabled that.
Sure. Yeah.
So it does get a message out to people who otherwise wouldn't have come across it.
Right.
I mean, even if the seminary, you mentioned people listening to our podcasts in Vietnam, We just simply couldn't afford to blanket the globe with pamphlets for Mid-America.
Right.
We couldn't kill enough trees to turn those into pamphlets and, what, dump out of, you know, C-17s or something.
Sure.
Mid-America.
Right.
Right. But we do have a platform where Mid-America's instruction via podcasting, via writing, is available all over the world to somebody searching for something reformed.
Right. It's no longer a, you know, a build it and they will know it sort of thing. It's intentional content creation, even from a seminary standpoint. That's, you know, the only medium now that's going to grab people's attention sometimes on the internet. And, you know, I think you said White Horse Inn. I think if there's any other sort of platforms that if I needed to know something theologically, you know, like Ligonier, for example, has just done an incredible job.
Oh, yeah.
And not just on their online presence, but publishing materials and resources for families and for churches. I mean, and just, you know, now Reform Forum here.
Reform Forum, I was going to say, some of our really good friends right up the road.
Right. They, I mean, how many episodes of Christ the Center have they been?
Mercy me.
It's way up there. So that too, for example.
Yeah, a lot of pros, a lot of really beneficial things that we can do. And I'm struck too, even locally, somebody might say, well, yeah, but we have, you know, we have a building on a corner. You know, why should our church have a website? Why should our church put sermons on it? If the neighbor who lives three doors over really wants to come into our church, then they can see our church. They can see our sign and they can come in. Well, on the one hand, the sign is a piece of technology, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you're choosing to have a sign,
right,
that means you seem to be in favor of a form of technology.
Sure.
What else can the web do? Right. I was struck by Tom Rainer, a little tiny book, Becoming a Welcoming Church. And Rainer has a chapter devoted to signage. And it's interesting the kinds of people he talked with and how they would speak about their decision to come to a church. They might say, well, I drove past this building, but vast majority of the people said the next thing I did was get home and Google the church and read their website. And the people who decided to come to a church did so because the information they got off their website was compelling to them. And the people who said they didn't come to a church overwhelmingly did so because of the website. He'll talk about people who said, I couldn't tell if there was a nursery, or I couldn't tell if what they would do with my kids, or I didn't know what their beliefs were there.
And it even goes down to the aesthetics of a website sometimes,
right,
too. I mean, if you've got something that just looks like it was born out of an HTML document with, you know, if there was any music playing, it'd be like 8-bit Super Mario. And
right,
every time you clicked a link, it'd be like, you know, the grab a coin sound effect or something like,
yeah,
that, you know. And there are, I'm sure there's still websites out there like that. But what does that say about a church, perhaps, if you're looking for one in your area and you see a website that is so far outdated, then, I mean, it's something that was bred in the dinosaur age.
Oh, it screams, we're not really interested in you. This is for our people here who need to know some data.
Mm-hmm.
You're kind of accidentally looking in,
right,
on our private little conversation.
Mm-hmm. And I know one of the first tabs that I try to look for whenever I do go to a church's website is the What We Believe,
yes,
tab. So it's placing things.
I thought you were going to say that. That's mine too.
Placing your, what we in the marketing world call your copy, your text, what you want people to know. Got to think through those things, even on a church website.
There was a church when we first moved out here that I really wanted to visit. Not in our tradition. But I just wanted to visit it, just sort of some breadth to enjoy our broader Catholicity. So it was a Protestant church, and I started trying to find information about it, and I poured through their website. It was a terrible website. It had no good information. Everything was outdated, and finally, I just took a gamble. I said, I'd like to go visit this church. It looks like they worship at this time. I'm going to hit the road. And I drove out and went there. But look how much effort it took physically to sit in front of my computer and decipher this website, and also just the psychological toll, the risk of saying, I'm jumping into something that I just don't know what they're doing. But it has potential, so right. I will do this. And in the end, it worked out. I met some nice folks there, and I was gracious. I didn't say, your website's horrible, but they probably should do something about that.
I mean, pre-internet, how would somebody have discovered and analyzed a church before they were to attend one?
Oh, my.
I don't know.
You can think of some of these old denominational handbooks that sure. you could purchase from
right.
Baker. You know, Baker had, I think, a dictionary of denominations, and maybe you'd get a you could look up all the Presbyterian denominations in the book, and maybe they'd have a mailing address or a phone number, which hopefully hadn't changed, and you could maybe write for some information,
yeah.
and maybe somebody would send you a church directory, and
sure.
maybe you would wind up there. But boy, how convoluted.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, we could just go on and on and on about the pros of the internet. And,
mm-hmm.
and look how churches have a real opportunity to placard their message in a venue where a huge number of local people traffic. I mean, this is almost like a bigger venue than putting a booth in at your local corn roast, you know, your local county fair where you have people there. I mean, this is an incredible opportunity to placard the message of salvation that that your church is proclaiming.
Well, as you heard, there are many pros to technology when it comes to the church, but what are some of the cons? Join Reverend Compton and I next time on Roundtable as we discuss the seeming pitfalls when it comes to the relationship between the church and technology. They aren't always good bedfellows. Stay tuned till then. In the meantime, you can find additional podcast episodes on our sermon audio and YouTube page, as well as Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and Google Podcasts. Be sure to search Mid-America Reformed Seminary. I'm Jared Luchabor. Till next time.